Hello, everyone. I'm Gorilla Monsoon.
And I'm your host, Bobby the Brain Heenan.
Oh, why don't you be serious? You're not the host, Brain.
Well, I should be.
Chris DeFrancesco is the host.
Chris DeFrancesco?
Yes, that's correct. Huh. I didn't stutter.
Didn't he get whacked in an episode of The Sopranos?
Oh, give me a break. He hosts a podcast, Brain.
Who the hell doesn't?
Well, his is about wrestling.
Who the hell's isn't?
He talks about old wrestling.
Wow. What a novel idea.
Oh, give me a break.
Next, you're going to tell me he's got a wrestling-themed name for the show?
Well,
Come on, Monsoon, spit it out.
It's the Hot Tag Wrestling Podcast.
So what?
And it's starting now.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome to the Hot Tag Wrestling Podcast. I'm Chris DeFrancesco. George Rogers. Oh, I'm sorry. Johnny B. Blood is here with us tonight. George, what's going on, man? How are you?
I'm going to keep this name forever. Now
it's
just
a good one.
Now it's just funny.
That's a good one. I like it.
I am creating this character in 2K23 as soon as we're done.
That's awesome. I want to see that as proof. Damn
it. My mind is all flutter with ideas. who are we kidding? I'm going to fall asleep with the controller in my hand.
Oh, that's great. So tonight, I know we're like almost a month late on it, but like I said on the Hot Tag Instagram page, we are going to be doing two shows this week, so we're going to catch up fairly quickly in terms of what our schedule is going to be. Tonight, we're going to be covering In Your House, Bad Blood from 1997. That happened on October 5th. It's one of the most infamous pay-per-views in the history of pro wrestling, or the WWF for that matter. The first ever, three major things happened. Let's just be real. One, the card sucked outside of the main event. However, three massive things happened on this night. One, they announced on the air the death of Brian Pillman. Second thing that happened is the first ever, and in my opinion, the best ever, Hell in a Cell match between Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker. The third thing that happened is the single greatest debut in pro wrestling history, which was the debut of the Big Red Machine, Kane. So that all happened on October 5th, 1997, and we're going to be talking about it, and we're going to get into it in a minute. I just want to go over some housekeeping things. I announced before last week, I announced that this is a regular now full-time podcast, and it's going to be that way for the foreseeable future. George and I have a lot of things planned. We have the rest of the year. I believe the rest of the year almost completely mapped out. I'm going to go over that with everybody in just a few moments here. Moving forward, we are going to start incorporating more discussions about what's going on currently. I know that Crown Jewel is this Saturday at 1 p.m. Eastern time on Peacock. Or if you're overseas, it's still the WWE Network, and I'm so jealous of you for that. So we'll be probably be covering Crown Jewel at some point next week. And then going into obviously what we're going to be covering next week as well, which I'm going to talk about right now. And as we alluded to last week, how things are going to probably work, George is going to pick a couple, I'm going to pick a couple, and we're going to go from there. So in November, of course, traditionally is one of the big four. One of the original big fours is the Survivor Series. So we're going to get four of them. George picked the first two, and I picked the two in the back end. The one that we're going to be covering next week, sometimes even I forget how monumental this pay-per-view was, but we're going to cover Survivor Series from 1996 next week. George, I'm so excited. Actually, no, we're covering that tomorrow. As we record this,
that's a tomorrow night recording, Christopher.
Yeah, that's going to be prime because I'm going to be watching that as soon as we get done recording this. For those of you who don't know what a monumental show Survivor Series 1996 was, inside Madison Square Garden, this was at a time where WWF was not doing well. But you could tell things were changing. Just to kind of name a couple things that happened that night. The debut of some dude named Dwayne Johnson. He went on to have a relatively decent career as The Rock.
A pretty modest career. I mean, not,
at best.
I mean, he didn't, I mean, he didn't set the world on fire. I mean, and what is that name anyway? The Maivia? Nobody cares.
Yeah, no one cares about Rocky Maivia. Yeah. I'm all about Flex Cavanna. So
yeah, hey, who is?
That was also the night where we saw a classic between Stone Cold Steve Austin and Bret the Hitman Hart. And that was also the night that we kind of started seeing the beginning of what the fans wanted at the time was a heel turn from Shawn Michaels. Because this was also the night where Shawn, coming in as the incumbent champion, the babyface, loses his WWF title to Sid Vicious, or Psycho Sid at the time. And as we'll talk about in that show, that MSG crowd, which was the barrier for success to Vince McMahon at that time, for a long time, for decades, that crowd, George, was all over Sid. I mean, they wanted Sid Vicious to walk out of that evening as a new champ, and he does.
Sid was hot.
And he was.
I think I forgot. I was like, yeah, the crowd loves Sid.
Yeah.
I mean, they loved him even more when he went back to WCW and Goldberg kept crushing his car. Some of the greatest acting of all time, folks.
I mean, that's acting from Sid and WCW that we were really missing on like General Hospital and Days of Our Lives. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we're going to be covering 1996 tomorrow. So that's going to kick off our November. And then next week, Survivor Series 1999. And then, by the way, that was George's pick. And then my two picks at the back end of November will be Survivor Series 2008 and Survivor Series 2009. So those are going to be what we cover in November, 96, 99, and 08 and 09. So I like how we kind of separated our choices in decades, which was not planned, but that's just how it worked out. So it was pretty cool. In December, it's basically what became an Armageddon pay-per-view for the WWF. So I chose Armageddon 2000, 2003, and 2007. And George is going to pick one or two in there as well. I don't know how many we're going to get to in December. I'm going to try to do what we did this week, where we're going to try to do two in 1 week. Because, again, it's the holidays. So December gets really difficult for me. And I'm sure George as well, from a work standpoint, I'm sure December can be quite rough.
I do work for the rulers of the free world, Amazon. So
you do. They, especially during this time, they do rule the world, as Sid would say.
Just like Sid.
I mean, Amazon's not quite Sid Vicious level yet, but they're getting
there. Psycho Sid level, at least.
They're at Psycho Sid, not like Sid Justice level.
A little better than Sid Justice.
So
that's where Disney's at right now. They're at Sid Justice level.
All right. So that's going to be November and December. Let's get to why we are here. We are talking the 10th Survivor Series event that took place inside Madison Square Garden in New York City, the world's most famous arena, especially when it came to the WWF. It's actually surprising to me, though, George, looking at this, it took them 10 Survivor Series to come to Madison Square Garden. I'm guessing, you know, they did other pay-per-views there, but you know, MSG is like that big fight deal. It's like a big deal. You would think it wouldn't have taken 10 years for a big four, one of the big fours, to be there for the first time. Like, that surprise you at all?
Big year in what, November? I mean, even in Madison Square Garden, you're still dealing with like the Knicks schedule.
Yeah, you are.
So that's probably part of it. And weren't the Rangers playing there too?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. At one point? So you figure you're competing with the Knicks and the Rangers in terms of availability and space. So maybe that's just how it planned out, is there wasn't any open spots for them. So,
So like I said at the beginning of the show, by 1996, the WWF had started to turn a corner. You know, for the better, in my opinion. Even though WCW at this time was mutilating them in the Monday Night Wars on Monday nights, as this was during the whole 83 weeks where Nitro was just regularly dominating Monday Night Raw. But then you kind of look at how the tide was starting to turn a little bit towards WWF, and that is the rise of Steve Austin. You know, you had the King of the Ring in 96. You had Mankind, who started catching big time fire in 96 as a great heel. And then you had the continued growth of guys like Hunter Hearst Helmsley. Then you have the arrival of The Rock. But then you still have Sid. You have Shawn Michaels, Stone Cold, Bret the Hitman Hart, The Undertaker. You know, they did their part. The stalwarts, the, you know, Taker, Shawn, Bret. You know, Michaels ascended to that top level of being a world champ in 1996. You know, that boyhood dream coming true at WrestleMania 12. You know, he went into this show with an 8-month title reign. You know, Bret Hart took most of 1996 off. And then you have, you know, with Hart paired with Mankind and Taker, working with Mankind, you know, they were put in positions to make those guys bigger stars. Taker, Hart was put in a position to make Austin a bigger star. Undertaker was put in a position to help Mankind become a bigger star here. Looking back at this now, George, 1996 for WWF, I mean, people talk about 97 being that pivotal year of change. That 97 doesn't take off if some of these dudes don't first get really over in 96. I thought 96 was a big year for the WWF.
They had to get the right pieces in place.
Yeah.
That's really how you can look at it. You know, 97 doesn't go off without a hitch if you don't have The Rock, if you don't have Austin,
right?
If Mankind doesn't get over, Triple H a little bit was starting to come into his own. I mean, he's still eating shit for the curtain call in 96, yep. Mm-hmm. But he's starting to get a little bit of steam going. Mm-hmm. And it's only a matter of time, you know, what, just the rest of 97, you know, he's, and as soon as 97 hits, he's feuding with Mankind. He's King of the Ring to where we are now in this pay-per-view. He's in DX.
Yep.
I mean, they haven't officially been named DX yet by this point, I think, mm-hmm. because that phrase didn't get coined until like a week later.
Correct. Yep.
So yep. Like if these guys don't land and connect with the fans,
mm-hmm.
then you don't have 97 at all. And I haven't mentioned this to you before, even I think when we talked about that Austin 316 speech, and when we talked about, and I think we even reviewed SummerSlam 96 at one point, mm-hmm. or we at least talked about it. Austin wasn't even on that card.
Nope.
For SummerSlam, which was like the next big pay-per-view after Florida. He wasn't on the card. He was on the pre-show. He was on the free-for-all, yep. Fighting way past his prime Yokozuna.
Mm-hmm.
But then like after that, you know, he starts coming out and he's calling out Bret, and we're like, shit, they're pushing him all the way to the top. They're sticking him with Bret like immediately. That's Bret's way of getting back to the company, of them bringing, yeah. Bret back. So they're going to have him in Austin.
Yeah.
And who knows, that probably would have just been a one and done match if Vince doesn't like how that turns out.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm really excited to talk about the Survivor Series 1996 tomorrow. But let's get to, I'm using filler here, ladies and gentlemen, talk a little bit more about Survivor Series 96, because Bad Blood 97 is really realistically a one match show. So I just want to talk a little bit, prepare everybody for how big of a show Survivor Series 96 is going to be. But let's talk about Bad Blood in Your House, October 5th, 1997. We're a year later from what we were going to be talking about tomorrow. A lot has changed. A month from this pay-per-view that we're talking about right now, George, the Montreal screw job happens. So this is like right in that in-between stage of just mega, mega things happening in the WWF. Looking at pay-per-view buys here, Bad Blood 1997, 186,000 buys, which is 50,000 buys higher than Ground Zero the month before the In Your House. And then it jumped all the way up to 285,000 buys for the Survivor Series a month later. But again, this is still a big time show. And we're in 97 now where things are hot. Austin is hot. DX is smoking hot. Bret Hart is, you know, God love him, literally one of the hottest heels in the industry right now. I mean, I don't care what anybody says. 97 Bret might have been my favorite Bret ever because he was unhinged. Bret was angry and unhinged at this point.
This was round sunglasses, Bret Hart.
This was round sunglass Bret. So again, and I brought this up to people in the beginning, to all of you people. That's awful of me. I'm sorry for that.
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah. So I in the top of the show, I said this is notable, this show, for three reasons. Pillman, Hell in a Cell, and, you know, Kane. So if you've seen this show or if you even read about it, you know, the first reason is that Brian Pillman passed away the night prior in his hotel room in Minnesota. He was scheduled to wrestle Dude Love at this event, so they had to improvise, you know, adding a match while also extending some of the others. You know, Pillman was one of those guys that could get over as a babyface or a heel. He cut incredible promos, like as just a maniac, literally just a crazy man. And then he was also pretty solid in the ring for a long time, but man, injuries. I think he had like an ankle injury that just completely derailed his career.
He got that in a car accident, right?
Yeah. I believe that's what it was. Yep.
It just never healed properly.
Nope. And of course, unfortunately, demons in the wrestling industry are far too prominent in this era. So, you know, his demon issues led to him dying of a heart attack. You know, he was part of the Hart Foundation group that really hit that huge stride in 1997. He was historically, we all know, best friends with Stone Cold Steve Austin. So, you know, Pillman was only 35 years old when he died here. So this was something that was brought up throughout the event. The other reason this show is famous is because it was the first ever Hell in a Cell match and it involved Taker and Michaels. Kind of building up to that, Michaels cost Undertaker the WWF world title when he accidentally hit Taker with a chair shot while Shawn was refereeing the SummerSlam main event title match, which between Taker and Hart, which ended up with Bret Hart becoming a five-time WWF champ. And this also continued the heel turn of Michaels because he didn't show any remorse after just snapping that chair over the head of the dead man and busting him wide open. And he really just became a tippy top heel at that point. Then they wrestled in September at Ground Zero. And it gets to this point now where it all led to this creation of the Hell in a Cell, which was a 15-foot high structure that covered the ring. There was room on the outside for action out there. It was unlike anything we'd ever seen before in a WWF. It was unlike anything I'd ever seen as a wrestling fan. You know, I was 11 here, turning 11. And I remember this. I got this pay-per-view, or I was allowed to get this pay-per-view. You know, did this have a hot feud between two great wrestlers that were in their prime? I mean, little did we know both of them had two primes. But, you know, this was also a gimmick match that had never been done before. So a lot of good stuff, man, was happening all at once going into this pay-per-view, George, that some of us forget sometimes. Michaels is becoming a tippy-top heel with DX. You got Undertaker, who is tremendous here. Bret Hart is just on all cylinders. Steve Austin, like, dude, 97. I was just talking big about 96, how that was a building block year. 97 is when the WWF was really putting it all together.
It kind of makes you – it kind of makes you wonder a little bit, especially when you look competition wise.
Yeah.
Because 97 was a hot year for WCW as well. I mean, mm-hmm. It was a great time to be a wrestling fan because you were, you know, you got to eat good on Monday nights.
Yeah, you did.
You got the feast. Yep. But, and then as we see, you know, even though Austin got his spine compacted 2 months prior to this at SummerSlam, mm-hmm. he still kept showing up on TV.
Yeah.
Which, yep. you know, which people were loving. The crowd was eating up every time he come out, just give someone else a random stunner. And then it was only a couple weeks before this event, he gives Vince the stunner for the first time ever.
Yep. And that's Madison Square Garden.
And that's massive because mm-hmm. even by this point, most of your television audience and people in the crowd, they don't know Vince is the company.
Nope.
It's not something that was ever really made like public knowledge. It wasn't mm-hmm. out there. It was always just assumed that Vince was just a color commentator. Yep. And that's, you know, and then, you know, Vince getting the stunner from Austin all the time. The Montreal Screwjob kind of gets Vince out from behind that desk mm-hmm. and really lets him put on, all right, you know, I'm the owner. And then this, you know, and then everything kind of goes from there.
Yeah.
But I mean, even Austin shows up here in the middle of the pay-per-view. Now mm-hmm. call it filler if you want, because of Pillman, but it fucking worked.
Yeah.
And everything with Austin just worked.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And just a reminder to people, another fun fact, this was Vince McMahon's final pay-per-view where he was the commentator.
Yeah.
This was the final time he sat behind that desk.
What a maneuver.
He pulled a work on all of us here. We didn't even know it was the end. From a storyline standpoint, there was incredible interest also with The Undertaker and Michaels, because Paul Bearer at this point had promised The Undertaker that Kane would arrive and that Undertaker's life, you know, would be ruined and never be the same again. You know, it was not universally known at this time when Kane would appear or where or what he would even look like. But, you know, when he came out and debuted at the end here, it was just so cool that this created something that would last 20 years. And we're going to get into that. They just did a great job building up to this main event and then ultimately the appearance of Kane. So we're going to get to that.
And I'll tell you, Chris, this is where we were spoiled mm-hmm. as an audience, like back then.
We were.
Is unless you subscribe to that Hacks fucking newsletter, or if you knew someone on the inside, or if you were like a tape trader or anything like that, you didn't know anything was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And now you can't go 5 minutes without somebody spoiling somebody's return because it's been leaked online.
Yeah.
Like now terrible. Everything is just, as we always tell, I was talking about like kayfabe being dead. Like there's no surprise element anymore. We just don't know. And I know right now there's the whole speculation, you know, of CM Punk coming to WWE, and there's reports left and right. There's hints that are clearly being thrown up on WWE TV, whether they're intentional or they're just there as little clever Easter eggs for people to pick up on. That's the thing. They are keeping this so close to the chest mm-hmm. that Meltzer's like, oh, you know, it's not happening. Talks fell through. But then we'll see another site who goes, no, the talks are continuing. But then we'll see mm-hmm. another one. Oh, CM Punk called and Vince and Triple H don't want him back. And then you see another one, like nothing that happened. There's so many conflicting reports. Nobody knows what's going to happen. But the biggest tell for me is the fact that they changed the set to open up more seats in the back, because the arena is completely sold out.
For Saudi Arabia?
No, for Survivor Series.
Oh, Survivor Series, right. I read that.
They opened up more seats to that. Was it the Allstate Arena in Chicago? Yep. They opened up more seats for that because of high demand.
Yep.
It's weird when something sells out and they have to open up seats, an actual mm-hmm. sellout, not some other bullshit.
Right. Not an arena that's, you know, tape, you know, can fit 10,000, but they tape off 8,000 of it because, you know, you can't sell.
Well, you know, camera side.
Of course. All right. So what I'm going to do is, since we talked for a while there, I'm going to take a break. I'm going to come back on the other side with a full slate here so we can get to this pay-per-view with fresh time. So this is the Hot Tag Wrestling Podcast. I'm Chris. That's Johnny B. Blood, George Rogers. We'll be right back in just a few moments. So stick with us. All right. Welcome back. Hot Tag Wrestling Podcast. We're going to be getting started here. Bad Blood 1997. Inside the Kiel Center in St. Louis, Missouri. Again, the Kiel Center, it's like you had the Cow Palace or the MGM Grand with WCW. And what was the other one that we covered a couple weeks ago? That was a WCW staple.
Oh, the one it was one of them. Yeah.
It was one of them. I feel like, you know, the Rosemont Horizon, and then you had like the Kiel Center. I just felt like I always heard the Kiel Center.
And the Gund Arena.
The Gund Arena, that's right. but the Kiel Center, man, was a big arena. It was like 21,000 people at this event here. So the announcers are, as usual in this time, Vince McMahon, Jim Ross, and Jerry Lawler. And like I said, this is the last pay-per-view where Vince McMahon would be the play-by-play guy. Sad day that we did not get to hear What a Maneuver 14 times during a match. But, you know, here we are. The first match here, 3-on-2 handicap match, Nation of Domination, which was Rocky Maivia, Kama Mustafa, which is the Godfather, or Papa Shango, as I would like to say, and D'Lo Brown versus the Legion of Doom. I didn't think it was awful. I actually thought, I mean, when Legion of Doom at this era had their working boots on, I thought they were still pretty damn good. They sold a lot better than I thought they would. There were times during this match where I'm like, damn, man, Hawk has some athleticism to him still. Mm-hmm. You know, Animal was always a good worker. I always enjoyed watching Animal. But, man, this match went about 4 minutes too long, man. Like, in my opinion, Nation of Domination got the win at about 12 minutes and 20 seconds. What did you think of this one? I just felt like it was overall not that great, but it just really went too long.
Yeah, I mean, it was a little bit too long, and I even texted you when I was watching it. It's like just the ridiculousness on commentary by Vince McMahon. Like, yeah. I'm glad this was the last one, because like D'Lo Brown gets, he's like, D'Lo Brown, the Lennox Lewis of the WWF. I'm like, I don't even know what this means.
I don't even think Vince knew who Lennox Lewis was.
Yeah, I think he just picked a fucking name, and he's like, oh, this works. Also, though, very telling, Rocky Maivia is the one who got the pin.
Yeah, and you could really tell the only positive, man, to this was that the hatred of The Rock, you could just feel, was growing to that fever pitch, because that was like, let's not forget, dude, like a year from this pay-per-view, The Rock is becoming world champion. So let's not forget, like, this is a building block at this pay-per-view. You could hear the crowd just hated Rocky Maivia. Like, they hated this dude. And like, you could see it building here. Like, that fire was a slow burn, and you could see it in this pay-per-view. That was the only positive I took from this match, was that, well, they wanted a big time heel out of The Rock, and they were getting it right around here. So that was big. And then, of course, immediately following this match, a tough moment, you know, with Vince McMahon announcing Brian Pillman's death, which they also did a little bit in the pre-show, but on Peacock, you don't get the pre-show. And I don't remember that. So I always thought that this was where it was announced. You know, and that was a pretty tough one, man, hearing Vince talk about that. It's even weird, even though I've watched this pay-per-view 500 times, it was weird hearing it like again and like seeing this happening live. And updating you throughout. It was just odd. But did you watch this pay-per-view live in 97? Like, to remember, how did you find out about Brian Pillman's death in 97?
I read about it in one of the various magazines that my grandmother would buy at the supermarket.
That's what I used to do. Yeah, I used to go get at the supermarket. Well, you know, they break up the death of Brian Pillman with Max Mini and Nova versus Tarantula and Mosaic. So there's that.
Skip.
Yeah, we're skipping. Don't worry. After that is,
I guess they just didn't have anything else. Like,
I guess not.
Nobody was ready to go. Like Too Cold Scorpio isn't back there, like munching a fucking hot dog. Like, Brian Christopher isn't doing anything at all.
Yeah. Definitely a time filler. Like, this is a 6.5 minute, almost 7 minute time filler, but you know, nothing to really talk about. Up next is the WWF tag team titles are on the line. The Headbangers coming in as champions versus the Godwins, with Uncle Cletus. Man, like, I will say this, the Headbangers were over. Like, they were popular at this time. The Headbangers here lose the WWF tag team titles at 12-17. I don't know what the WWF are thinking here to give the Godwins titles, but nonetheless, I mean, it was crazy seeing one of the Godwins wearing that Confederate flag on his jeans on the knees there. I noticed that real quick. I'm like, oof, things you won't see in 2023. But what were your thoughts on this match? I actually enjoyed watching the Headbangers, which is weird to say.
It was amusing. It was a good tag team match. It made me miss like tag teams, like tag teams. But I think those are going to start coming back because I noticed DIY is back together.
Yes, DIY is back together.
Gargano and Ciampa. So we'll see. We'll see if like Triple H being in charge, if he's going to try and bring us back to some days of yore. But like, I remember like when they came out, I was like, oh, look, the Headbangers are tag team champions. That's weird. Because I figured they were, but I don't think I ever remembered them holding the titles. Like, I was like, oh yeah, they're champions. But you could have asked me when. I'd been like, ah.
Yeah. I agree. Someday. I mean, overall, I thought it was a pretty bad match. It was a pretty good example of the tag division in 1997. It wasn't great. It would get better the following year. I mean, significantly better in the next couple years. But, you know, you could tell still in 97, there were still a highlight of tag teams. I mean, this match got, you know, almost 12.5 minutes. So it was still a focal point of the show for sure. You know, following that, we see a video package showing all the people that Steve Austin has been given stunners to while being, you know, hurt, being out injured. I can't even begin to describe, and George, you pinned this, you know, perfectly a few minutes back, how impactful it was that even though Austin was hurt, that he was still appearing on every Raw. He was showing up like tonight on these pay-per-views. It was so impactful because it was such a breath of fresh air every time you saw him, because you knew that you were going to be getting something fresh, something new, and something that was meaningful. Because in 97, every time Steve Austin was on your screen, it meant something. So it was good that they were keeping him involved throughout this pay-per-view as well.
Absolutely. In fact, even like during this Intercontinental title match between Owen Hart and Farooq for the vacant Intercontinental title.
Yes.
The weird thing is, as I'm watching the pay-per-view, I kind of forgot there was a match going on because they kept showing the shit Austin was doing at ringside.
Yep.
You know, he was a timekeeper, Ryan DeBell. He jumps over and like grabs a headset and gets on commentary, and then goes on to the Spanish commentary, and then goes on to the French commentary. Like, he just himself took all the attention away from the match.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Farooq and Owen could have been doing a five-star classic in the ring, and we would have never known, because our eyes are on Austin and what he's doing.
Yep. I agree. And that's why I said it was just so vital to have him there. But it did take all the attention away from other things that were happening, especially, you know, for the Especially for that Intercontinental Championship, that vacant title between Owen Hart and Farouk, because that's what's up next here. And boy, I mean, you talk about styles clash.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and, you know, look, Owen Hart could pretty much, you know, have at least a 4-star match with a broom if you asked him. But man, this was really tough to get through. And it looked like it was tough for them to get through it. And it wasn't that interesting. And it really needed Austin showing up. And, you know, it's probably because it was a heel versus a heel. Like, these are two heels battling here. It was more of an angle than a match. This, you know, amazingly though, this pay-per-view was the last one that Austin would miss for like 2 years, despite that bad neck that he suffered at that SummerSlam when Owen Hart dropped him on his skull. But yeah, man, you know, I just was not a fan of this match whatsoever. And I almost was like, oh, thank God we got Austin here. But what was your thoughts on it?
I mean, I like Owen. I've always been an Owen fan.
Yeah.
I like Ron Simmons, Farouk, whatever you want to call him. I mean, it's two just completely different styles. Ron Simmons, for everything he's good at, he doesn't have the technical prowess that Owen has to really kind of give you a solid match. And Owen's not a brawler.
No.
So it's just, it's hard to kind of watch it and really get invested, because you're like, these are two really good wrestlers that just didn't really learn to work together. Now you get a pretty good mix out of it just because of the performance center. So if you get two guys who have some conflicting styles, you can just have them go, all right, you know, just go spend, you know, a day or two or like 12 hours in the performance center and see what you can bang out. Like, just to kind of give you a little bit of an example, just what we got coming up in present day, is it looks like we're probably going to have at some point down the line a match between Gunther and The Miz.
Yes.
You talk about two completely different wrestling styles.
Yep.
Like, yep.
Completely.
Yeah.
100% totally different wrestling style.
And like, if this was 97, they would just thrown together and it would have been, you know, a match, and it would have been bowling shoe ugly.
Oh yeah.
But it would have been two guys just doing what they're good at, trying to get it work. But now you can actually have them like, all right, you know, let's go work on this. We'll go down to the performance center and, you know, see what we can kind of bang out, like hash out and see what'll work. The guys nowadays are, and I know in WWE, everyone is trained to a very specific style. You know, it's to their style, but there is negatives to it and there are positives to it. The positives of it is you have people who have the different styles who can work together. I'm like, all right, let's try to figure this match out. Because when you see it anywhere else, it doesn't look as good. Like an Impact or NWA or
the
shit down in Jacksonville. It just doesn't, it looks bad. But when you see it at a company that actually hones the skills of their people, like, all right, well, this can kind of work a little bit. Mm-hmm. But in 97, you didn't have that. Yeah, two guys just trying their best to give you what they could.
I agree.
And I don't even want to give it a bad score, because I like both of those guys a lot. It's just, it's a hodgepodge.
It is. Yeah, it is. You feel for it a little bit. Next up, next match here is DOA, Disciples of Apocalypse. You got Crush, Chains, 8-Ball, and Skull versus the Los Boricuas of Savio Vega, Jesus Castillo, Jose Estrada Jr., and Miguel Perez Jr. If you want to know what maybe one of the worst feuds in WWF tag team history was, it's this. They had multiple pay-per-view matches against one another between, you know, single matches, regular tag, 6-man, 8-man. And, bro, they all sucked. Like, I went back and watched some of the Raws with these teams, and boy, oh boy, bowling shoe ugly, as you said. You know, Crush got the win with that backbreaker at 9 minutes and 10 seconds. I mean, it was a clean pay-per-view win, I guess, for DOA. So there's that. I guess I'm sure you have no opinion on this.
This was the only opinion I really had on this. if Crush would have stayed in WWE, he would have fit beautifully into the Ministry of Darkness.
Yeah, I mean, he was also one of Taker's boys.
So, yeah, he was
one
of the Bone Street, yeah.
Yeah, so that would have worked out well. I mean, he's such a big guy, too. It's a shame that it just didn't do any. He didn't go anywhere.
Of course, in a match like this, there's only two guys that are going to be getting the pinfalls. It's either going to be Crush or it's going to be Savio.
Correct.
Ain't going to be anybody else.
Nope, it is not.
Chains ain't getting no fucking wins. I'm telling you that.
I agree.
I remember when Tommy Dreamer knocked him off the scaffold in a scaffold match in ECW.
Next up is a flag match. You heard it. Bret Hart and the British Bulldog versus the Patriot Invader. Which one of these are not like the other? Bret was the WWF champ here. His title wasn't up for grabs on this show. You know, the flags here are the prize. They're placed on the ring post, despite the fact that Bulldog was British. I guess he did live in Canada. Vader didn't come off as
a he was married to a Canadian.
That's true. And, Vader, that proud American that he that always,
proud,
that patriotic that, beast.
from Stone Mountain, Georgia, that, yeah. The heart of America.
Dude, this went 23 minutes. The best part of the match, I think, came was like with the last 5 minutes when a drunken fan got into the ring to get Bret, and he got stomped on by taken out by security. That was awesome. The finish came soon after Bret Hart, beating up the Patriot with a roll up, even though Hart was taking a beating for a while. Hart grabbed the tights as well because that's what heels do. It was okay. It was just about five to eight minutes too long. It felt like a TV match to me, like a Raw match more than anything. But I feel like how they said, they had to add time to matches. I felt like they added time to this one and it didn't warrant it. If I felt bad for Bret here, because not only is he working, probably not the greatest of moods, one of his friends just passed away the night before. You could also, in a way, George, sense that he kind of knew that the company was losing faith in him by giving him a tag match and main eventing Undertaker and Shawn Michaels, as he's a top heel in the company right now, and he's in a tag match with a flag involved. So I'm pretty sure Hart wasn't in the best mindsets going in. Little did he know that his whole world was going to suck in a month. Nonetheless, man, this was a tough... looking back, man, you wonder why Bret Hart was angry so much. This couldn't have been one of the happier moments of his year.
Hey, a lot of people get blindsided out of nowhere when your world comes crashing down.
Yeah.
But poor Bret. Damn. it's a shame when you think about it, because he wins his title at SummerSlam two months prior. And his major feuds are his major feud, not feuds, feud,
one feud.
The fucking Patriot. I completely forgot he had Kurt Angle's music. So I'm sitting there and the music hits and I'm like, what? And then I'm like, oh, that's right. Him and Slaughter both had this music before Kurt had it.
Yeah.
But I'm just like, and I'm looking at the Patriot. I'm like, at what point are we even looking at this guy as
anything?
This is a main event caliber player right here. Yeah. And I'm not trying to shit on Del Wilkes, but
yeah, rest in peace,
dude. You legit just came into this company and they're just throwing you basically to Bret.
Mm-hmm. The world champion.
just to give Bret a couple wins before they go and drop the hammer on him.
Yeah, it's I mean, literally a month later, gone. Just,
I mean,
gone.
But this was also a bit of a downside tonight. So as you're trying to get all these pieces in place, you really don't have a big main event roster.
You don't. You're right.
I mean, you got Shawn and Taker. I mean, they're your other two main eventers. They're in their own match. I mean, you probably could have thrown Mankind in there if Mick Foley wasn't feuding with Pillman, but I mean, and Vader was just he wasn't Vader anymore. Basically, it was rough.
It really was. It really, really was. Hey, look, we all know, not to take a quick little turn here, but if any of y'all were wondering how big of a night Dynamite was,
oof,
hit Paul me. White is back.
With the worst entrance music I've ever fucking heard.
So, you know, there's hey, that.
Don't worry, guys, because he's going to team up with Chris Jericho. That's right. Jericho is reforming, folks. And Kenny Omega. One of these things is definitely not like the other.
All of them suck. I don't care.
And I mean, Omega. He's the only one under 50.
We get to the backstage area here where Shawn Michaels delivers a tremendous promo where he sarcastically makes fun of the fact that this match is not for his coveted European title.
Very, very relieved.
Yes, very much so. So much so, he was wiping the sweat off of his brow. Mm-hmm. And then he delivers a famous HBK line, which he goes, "Ain't nobody crazy enough to do this gig except for the Heartbreak Kid." Love just it. He's just, God, he is just the GOAT, man. Awesome visuals of the cage coming down that follow. And I just, to this day, when I watch this match, I just get chills, man. Like, I just get chills. And then the sexy boy music plays, and he is so hated. I mean, there's bottles being thrown, there's cups being thrown. And he's just walking down the aisle, man. And he just, like, you people want to talk about today about, you know, Roman having swag or heels today having swag. Bro, you walk down the aisle in 1997 with real heat like Shawn Michaels had. Yeah, you don't know. There's no such thing as heat today, brother, when you have HBK just walking down the aisle and getting smacked in the face with full beer bottles and beer cans and people literally just like coming at you and just not a care in the world. And it's just badass. And, and then Taker with a great entrance with a huge pop. And like, I get so geeked out by this match, man, and I'm going to get into it. Like, before the match even starts, I watch this and I go, God, Shawn Michaels is the greatest to ever live. The cage is lowering and he's almost having a hissy fit because he knows that Triple H has to leave the ring and there's nowhere for him to go. And like, Undertaker comes out and he's in the corner acting all tough. And then you see the camera pan from behind Michael. So you can see Taker at the far steps about to do his normal thing where he pops the lights on. And like, you see Michaels like react like he was terrified. He hops out of the ring and he's like out. He's like yelling out of the cage and he's yelling at Vince McMahon. Like, you see him yelling at Vince McMahon and like JR and King are acknowledging that Vince is getting yelled at by Shawn Michaels. And it's like, dude, before the match even starts, it's like he's already sold it. He's already sold the stakes of this match. And now he's inside and you can't get out. And then it's like you go through the beginning of the match and he's just taking bump after bump. And everything that Undertaker is throwing at him is just, everything is like the end of the world. And he's just selling like a madman. Like, he's doing, you know, you go on later, he's doing tope suicidas into the cell. He's doing things that you just never saw before. And, you know, Taker putting him in a bear hug and going, you know, Cage corner to the outside post, cage post. Bro, like this match, it's, you know, it's my second, you know, 1B, my favorite match of all time. And I just live every second of this match. They get to the outside and Shawn Michaels does two drop kicks on concrete and then gets slingshotted. And as soon as he hits the cage, the camera pans and the blood everywhere.
Yeah.
Like, it's got to be one of the best blade jobs you've ever not seen because it was so quick and so sudden. Man, then you get up top and it's like, now you're going to die, Sean. Now you're dead. And I'm talking a lot here, George, but now take me through your mindset of this match, because you and I are marks for Sean. We both, he's our favorite of all time, untouchable in the ring. Take me through your mindset of this match.
I mean, you're painting such a beautiful picture. I was just letting you go. I mean, it's the same way you're looking at it. And it's just, you know, Taker's basically using Sean as a lawn dart, like launched him into the side of the cage. We're seeing stuff that we haven't seen to this extent. You know, in cage matches, it's all like the blue bar. You know, we didn't even have like the chain link cage at this point.
No,
I mean, you see it a little bit in the, you know, somewhere else, but we saw the blue bars at this point.
Yeah.
Or the black bars, whatever you want to call them. Mm-hmm. But there was just so much going on. And then you go to the top of the cell, which, you know, it's like shit. They're like, you know, 20 feet in the air. This is a whole new world now, especially for the WWE, especially for this company to take this kind of risk. You know, Sean's taking bumps on top of the cell, and like every time he goes down, you're like, you're holding your breath because you know it's chain link and that shit could snap at any fucking minute, you know?
And then
Sean just takes that bump, like not from the top of the cell, but like about halfway down. I mean, he's down it, and then Taker just kind of like stomps on his hands and he falls and he goes through the table, and the table had zero give.
Zero.
Yep. It's not like now where you hit the table, like maybe you bounce a little bit and you go through it. No, he went straight through the damn table like it was cardboard right to the ground.
Yeah. Yeah. It was.
It's new territory for us.
It is.
Like you talk about the Attitude Era. I mean, shit, we're getting in spades right here. And we were getting it and we didn't even know we had it at this point.
You absolutely correct. And, you know, like I said, you know, Taker in the beginning, he stalks him back in the inside where he nails Sean with a big boot to the head that Sean just sells like he got shot by a double barrel shotgun. You know, Taker tosses him in a turnbuckle three times and goes for the chokeslam. But Sean, you know, he fires back with those real stiff right arm punches. Taker whips him to the corner. Sean does the upside down, inside out, bounces off. It gets drilled by a clothesline. And you know, Taker works on Sean's shoulder, and then he goes and inside the cell, he does old school. And, you know, he follows with a leg drop. Taker whips Sean into the buckle and tosses him over the top. You know, it's like, it was just one thing after another, man. And it's like, there was a point where even on the inside of the cell, not outside the cell, they're on the outside of the ring, Sean's trying to climb the cage just to get away, because at that time you feel like once you're in, there's no getting out. So Sean's trying to escape by just climbing the cage. Yeah. And it's just telling that story of there's nowhere for you to go. And you're in there with the Undertaker, and he has a bone to pick with you big time. Like, you cost him the WWF championship. And, you know, Sean's bouncing off and getting decked with clotheslines on the outside of the ring. It was like a physical dissection by the Undertaker, which I think is what I heard JR say at one point. It was just awesome. It was just flat out unbelievable watching these two just go back and forth.
I mean, you got all this going on. You have... For all intents and purposes, you have a 5-star classic right here in the making. And you're not even at the best part of the damn match yet. And
I know.
It's the part that nobody saw coming, because it's not something you can predict.
Yeah.
It's just something that's being said. And it's not even in your mind, because all you can think about is the fact that there is this feud between Taker and Sean, and it's a blood feud.
Yep.
And it's and then it, they're going so hard and they're throwing everything out that on the outside of all of this is Paul Bearer just saying your brother Kane is coming, and holy shit, did he come?
Yeah. Oh,
he came and he came hard.
Yeah, it was just like I said before, you get to the point where, you know, Sean's doing planches through the middle rope. You know, Taker's head's bouncing off the cell. Sean does a part where he climbs the cage and drops an elbow on the outside, like just a really cool spot. Sean gives Undertaker a pile driver on the steel steps. You know, he can't get him up, almost botches the move. I mean, there's a cameraman right there, but it was just a vicious pile. Like, you could hear Undertaker's head hit the top of that, those steps. Sean makes his way up. He just tells the cameraman vividly, audibly, get the F out of here and get this, you know, get this shit away from me. But
he stomped on the cameraman at one point.
Yeah, he beat the piss out of the cameraman.
That poor guy, he got paid in peanuts.
He did. You know, Sean gets a chair and, you know, carries on from the last 2 months of the storyline, starts drilling Taker in the back with the chair. And it's just wild, dude. And it just kept going and going and going. You get to the very top, and then eventually he just, you know, they wrestle up top a little bit. You know, there's a point where Taker scoop slams Shawn Michaels, and the cameraman is in the middle of the ring, and you can see the blood falling from Michaels onto the camera, and you hear the cameraman say, "Oh shit," because there's blood falling from the top of the cell. And it's like, you've never, for me, I didn't know ECW in 1997. This was brand new territory for me. This was brand new territory for the majority of wrestling fans. Because you didn't see anything like that in WCW, even at their height, they didn't really have blood. You didn't see that kind of stuff happening. Like, this is pushing the envelope. Like, this is shredding every envelope that you knew of that could happen within the confines of a match in the WWE. And dude, like, you're shitting your pants seeing what Undertaker might be doing here to Shawn Michaels at the top of that cage. And then it happens. He kicks his fingers off and knocks him off the cage, and he falls through a table that's not prepped at all. Just goes through the table, dude. Like, what an awful bump it was.
There's wires on the table, too. It hasn't been cleaned off or anything.
No, and, like, Michaels is just bleeding profusely. Like, he looks like a dead man. Like, a dead dude that's now wrestling. So, we're going to take a really quick break, and we're going to come back on the other side, and we'll wrap it up. But
a dead man fighting the dead man.
My God, the irony. What is this, SummerSlam
1994?
Oh, no. All right, Hot Tag Wrestling Podcast. We'll be right back in seconds to wrap up Bad Blood 1997. Stick with us. Welcome back, Hot Tag Wrestling Podcast. And we're getting to the nitty-gritty here. And look, we get back in the ring, and Sean gets probably the receiving end of, can we say, a top five chair shot of all time?
Oh, it was stiff.
I mean, you talk about a receipt. I mean, Sean has been on record saying that was a receipt. So,
I mean, that wasn't as bad as the one that I sent you guys from ECW, where Mikey Whipwreck basically murdered Cactus Jack so hard he changed his name when he came to another company.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely agree. But man, this was, it was just something else, dude, like, to get to the end here. You know, Taker hip tosses Michaels onto the broken table after picking him up. Sean's blood is pouring everywhere. His whole face is covered. JR proclaims that he's never seen anything like this in his life. I'm probably sure you probably heard that a million times. Taker drags Sean to the inside, and they come back in the ring as the cage is locked for the second time, setting that one up perfectly. The crowd is hot as Taker delivers a big chokeslam with the top rope, and a move that I still think is such a badass move. Sean is helpless at this point. Taker brings in a chair, and like I said, just delivers a debilitating chair shot to Shawn Michaels' skull.
I mean, that chair shot hit him so hard that I got a headache.
Yeah.
30 years later.
Right. Taker signals, as always, the cutthroat for the end, but the lights go out. Seconds later, the organ plays. The building is covered in red light, and there's a familiar person walking through the curtain, and that is Mr. Paul Bear himself, walking through hellfire and brimstone. And oh my God,
man,
it's
gotta be Kane, right?
It's Kane, right? I mean, that's gotta be Kane.
It's gotta be Kane.
Gotta be Kane.
Gotta be.
Kane rips the door.
Said that like 50 fucking times. I know, and we always make the joke because when they show him, that's always what you hear. I didn't realize Vince said it so many more times afterwards. It's like, dude, this is why you pulled yourself off of commentary.
And I will say this, and I agree. Looking back now, I'm trying to hold a sneeze off here, but I don't know if it's going to work, but we'll see. I agree with Bruce Pritchard, where he has said during this show that during his show covering this pay-per-view, where he wished desperately, he wished Vince would not have said a single word until Kane and Undertaker met face to face in the ring that night. Like, let the suspense for the viewer build. Don't just tell us right away that it's Kane. We know it's Kane probably because it's Paul Bearer, but let that moment build a little bit and let them tell me that it's Kane when you see them meet face to face and you see the look and the blood just drained from the face of the Undertaker. Like, let that be the moment where he looks at his brother, and then you hear Vince say, I mean, that's gotta be Kane. Don't give it to me literally the second he walks out of the curtain. You know what I mean?
No.
Like, tell me that's let that story build a little bit. Kane walks down, rips the door off the hinges, throws Earl Hebner into the cage, stares the Undertaker down. He sets three of the four ring posts on fire. Taker looks away and is met with a kick to the gut and a tombstone from Kane, who had to spin around because he had to find the hard camera. I laugh at that all these years later, but he still nails it.
He was probably looking for the tarped off area.
He would, yeah, not in the Kiel Center that night. Bear throws, you know, water on the ref to get him to wake up so that he can count the pinfall. Shawn crawls on top of the Undertaker and gets to 1, 2, 3, thus giving him the number one contender spot at the Survivor Series the following month for the WWF title.
I
wonder what happens. Probably nothing too famous or noteworthy.
I mean, you probably just skip that paper. You guys don't need to watch it.
Yeah. The match went exactly 30 minutes. HBK gets the win by pinfall. Bro, like, can I give this like 10 stars?
You can.
I'm going to give
podcast.
Yeah, this is my podcast. Yeah, that's right. I'm going to give this 10 stars, man. I mean, the ending, sometimes you would think an ending like that would hurt it, but not this one. This one, like, it was incredible that what we got in the ending here. Like, we got a 10-star match itself, and then you add the debut of Kane and what that brought and what that encompasses, and it just adds 10 to 15 more stars to this.
Yeah.
I've had so much to say about this match, guys, that are listening to this, because it's one of the greatest matches ever in wrestling history. I've watched it probably 50 times, start to finish. No joke. I'm probably underselling the amount of times I have watched this match, because it's perfect. It's like that favorite movie or like your favorite television show that it will never get old to me. This was one of the most anticipated matches ever. Nobody knew what a Hell in a Cell looked like until the pay-per-view. No one really knew how big it was or what the structure was until they lowered it to the ring on the pay-per-view for the first time. And, you know, throwing HBK into this match, you knew it was going to be unbelievable because 1997 Shawn Michaels was untouchable. As much as his 2002 to 2010 to me is his greatest reign of all time, Shawn Michaels 1997 was unhinged. Like, nobody in the world was even close to Shawn Michaels' level. So then you add him into this maniacal situation, you know what you're getting. And then you throw The Undertaker in there, who's, you know, one of one in terms of his character. And then you look at the in-ring performer. It's just, it was perfection, just perfection. The blood was incredible. It was one of the best blade jobs I've ever seen. I'm not a big blood guy, but it fits the circumstance. It fits the gimmick. It fits the story of what they were trying to tell here. And I think it's one of the greatest feuds in the history of wrestling. It spanned 20 years and it ended at WrestleMania 25 and 26. I mean, it ended a Royal Rumble in 2007 where people only remember, like, people remember that pay-per-view because of that 8-minute meeting they had at the end of the Rumble. You know, so many things could have went wrong in this match because, again, it was unlike anything they ever did. But start to finish, it was perfect. Even the angle with the cameraman was perfect. It was executed to perfection. It was the excellence of execution, and it didn't even need Bret Hart. You know, just being able to do the things that they did, the storytelling was perfect. Shawn Michaels being that chicken shit heel in the beginning and at certain points trying to climb up the cage to just get away, only to just continue to get destroyed and manhandled. Everything that Shawn was able to take and then to dish. Undertaker doing his part of being phenomenal, just a monster in that ring, the Phenom. And the crowd just ate it all up. This match had everything, George, from a storyline, the heat for both men, the psychology was great, the timing was perfect, the big bumps, the bump all through the table, and then you throw in the fact that it was probably the second best performance by The Undertaker that I've ever seen besides WrestleMania 25 or in, you know, even some of his matches I felt, you know, that he had with Batista and with Edge at WrestleMania. And then you look at the debut of Kane was just the most memorable debut ever. The best debut ever. The only one to me that comes close is Jericho in 99. It set the tone for a 20-year partnership, rivalry, Brothers of Destruction, WrestleMania matches. Everything, George, that could go right went great. And that's why it's simply put one of the best professional wrestling matches ever.
And if you want to talk about a rarity in the wrestling world, seamlessly, this match alone ended one story and started another within the match itself.
Yeah.
I mean, like, with this match, the story between Shawn and Taker was done. Shawn was about to move on to the title picture to make Bret tap out to the sharpshooter in Montreal.
Mm-hmm.
While at the same time, The Undertaker is starting his longest, best feud of his career with Kane, who debuts and who makes his debut in this match. It's seamless, and it's such a rarity to see it anymore in wrestling. Now you get the match, and then that's it.
Yeah,
like it's like a work of art.
Yeah,
to I be agree. Studied just for years, and credit to Glenn Jacobs for never giving up on it in this company and in wrestling in general. I mean, he didn't exactly start off, you know, setting the world on fire as Dr. Isaac Yankum. We all know how Fake Diesel panned out.
Yep.
I mean, all he had to do was just wait for like the right gimmick. And it came. Holy, I mean, Taker and Kane, just two of the longest, most substantial gimmicks in wrestling.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, you got Flair doing the Nature Boy shit, but that's Flair. That's just him. Like, when Kane isn't on WWE TV, he's Glenn Jacobs somewhere else. When The Undertaker is on TV, he's Mark Calloway somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this, like, it's, who would have thought in 97 that this random debut, Kane, was just gonna set the, excuse the pun, set the wrestling world on fire.
Yeah.
So to speak.
Mm-hmm. An adversary and an opponent for The Undertaker for 2 decades.
Yeah. And a tag team and a tag team partner.
Right. That's right. Yeah. That's what I said. An opponent and a partner.
You said adversary.
I'm sorry. Adversary and an opponent. I'm sorry. Adversary and a partner.
Yeah.
For the next 20 years. And
yeah,
just awesome. Oh my God. I get so riled up when I cover this one and I love it. Out of 10, what do you give this show? My score is going to be weird, but I'll explain.
The show on the whole is not good, but the main event is just that good. It saves the entire show from being a nightmare.
Yeah.
I'm giving it an 8.
Hmm.
Solely off of the main event. Because the rest of the show itself is largely forgettable.
I agree. I was going to be right around that 7 or 8. And that 7 or 8 is strictly main event based. Everything on the surface, if you take that main event out of there, this is a 1 or a 2 pay-per-view. Like, it was bad. Like, this was a bad show. You take that main event out and it's just like, woof, like, just not good. So yeah, based on the main event itself, I'm going to be with you right there between that 7 and 8. And that's strictly because it was a one match show, but that one match will live forever. And, just awesome stuff. This was a lot of fun. It was a little bit longer than normal, but it deserved it.
People can talk Taker, Mankind, Hell in a Cell, King of the Ring 98, all they want. I mean, at the end of the day, that's just a spot fest that we're watching.
Yep.
Like, and I don't mean any disrespect to Undertaker. I definitely don't mean any disrespect to Mick Foley. But that's really what that match was. Everybody remembers it because Mick took all these wild bumps and he went through the cell and shit.
But there was no psychology. There was no story. Yeah.
It was chaos is what it was.
But it wasn't the first. So that's. No. You'll always remember the first, and this is what that was.
You always remember your first time.
You always do. So that was, ladies and gentlemen, Bad Blood from 1997 in your house. Tomorrow night, we'll be right back here, Thursday, November 2nd. We're going to be covering Survivor Series 1996. We're going to go back a year, and that's going to be a fun one too. We have a lot of good stuff to talk about that. We talked a little bit about, we prepped you a little bit in the top of this show. But tomorrow is the real thing. I'm going to have to go upstairs right now, actually, at 11:45 p.m. Eastern time. I'm going to watch the pay-per-view. I'm going to get that taken care of.
I have 11:46, so maybe you should fix your clock.
Oh, it is 11:46. You're right. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to have this pay-per-view fresh on my mind for tomorrow night. George, thank you very much. I really appreciate you hopping on here, as always. You are the man. It's always time to play the game for Johnny B. Blood, and I'm grateful for it. At the Hot Tag Podcast on Instagram, check us out over there. And of course, anywhere you listen to podcasts, follow us, find us, the Hot Tag Wrestling Podcast. We will be at some point soon, hopefully beginning in the new year, we will be streaming these episodes live and we'll be talking about these live on the air. We'll be getting to that point soon. So just stick with us. And I'll have more information on that shortly, but looking to launch that during the Royal Rumble season. So why not, right? All right, so for George Rogers, I am Christy Francesco, and we'll catch you guys down the road. Have a great one, and we'll see you tomorrow. Bye-bye. Yeah.